Hello, everyone.
Hey, guys. Thanks for coming to our talk. My name is Brant Westing, and I'm the panel organizer. I just wanted to introduce the panel today. We've got leaders. We have leaders in the field of human-computer interaction here, and so we're going to have a 60-minute panel discussion about gesture systems, new computer interfaces, and the future of HCI. And our moderator is Carla Vega, and she's with the Texas Advanced Computing Center here at the University of Texas at Austin. She's going to serve as a neutral moderator. The topic of our panel is interface technology, gesture systems, and beyond. And it sounds like something Buzz Lightyear would say. We actually had to change the name of our panel. It was originally called Minority Report, Are We There Yet? So we'd like to talk about that, and we've actually managed to get one of the guys from Oblong here who worked on the Minority Report gesture system. So he's here as well. So I hope you guys enjoy the panel session, and I'm going to go ahead and hand it off to Carla, who will get us started on the discussion. Thanks.
So like Brant said, we have five really good panelists. So the way that this is going to work is I have prepared some questions for them to answer. I'm also monitoring the tweet feed, hashtag South by Southwest, hashtag gesture. If you have a question, please submit it there, and I'll try to see if I can ask these guys. Otherwise, we'll have around 10 minutes at the end for questions. And so we're going to go ahead and start. So the first question for all the panelists, so they can introduce themselves, is how does your research or work contribute to the topic? So we'll start with Brant.
Okay. Thanks, Carla. So I've got a video, actually, I'm going to show. I work at the Texas Advanced Computing Center Visualization Laboratory, which is on main campus at UT Austin. And in that lab, we do a lot of research with interacting with large high-resolution display systems. So I've got a video to show that shows some of our research in that area. Just to illustrate, I think that's the best way to illustrate what we do. So We use the Kinect a lot in the lab, and we really like it because how cheap it is and what it enables us to do. So the first video here is showing how we use the Kinect to interact with our very high-resolution display system. This system is called Stallion. It's currently the world's highest-resolution display, and it's a total of 300 megapixels. And we've really enabled it to be used by the sciences and arts, and we've added these gesture interfaces to it to enable easier interaction. So we really like this as a test bed for large display systems and high-resolution display systems. This is just kind of an example of how we've enabled this research. We also are in the business of doing very large touch displays, and so this is rapidly sped up, but this is a gesture-based interface to large touch displays. This is a 12-megapixel display, and we can interact with it with gestures. We can do collaborative visualizations, and that's where our research is headed in this area. It's kind of what people call it, the Texas-sized iPad. Okay, and I'll hand it off to you, Henry.
Thank you, Brant. I'm Henry Holtzman. I'm at the MIT Media Lab. I run a group we call Information Ecology, and we're really interested in how people interact with computers, devices, technology in general. And what I want to talk about today is really a series of projects that show trying to engage all of the senses as a human, or at least each project engaging a different sense. So starting out with the sense of sight, this is a gesture display we created in collaboration with the camera culture group. We call it the bidirectional display. And it's a gesture interface system that's kind of unique in that the ones you usually will see either operate as a touch gesture, like your iPad or your iPhone, so right on the surface, or from far away, like a Kinect, where you need to be 5 or 6 feet away. But this system actually works touch through proximity to the display, and also it works optically by turning the entire display into a camera as well as a display, which is why we call it the BiDi screen. And it can be miniaturized into something that could be like a tablet or a cell phone. So this is a three-dimensional gesture system you could take with you on the go. In the second example here, you see a first-person shooter kind of world being steered by where the person puts their hand. So if they want to go forward, they move their hand forward, look up, up, down, down, left, right, whatever. The third one is a really interesting example. It's about to come up. It shows using light to interact with the display because it's a light-sensitive display. And so here we're using a flashlight to illuminate the virtual world behind it. So it's a really interesting real-world, virtual-world merge here. Our display can pick up, it's basically a 4D light field input display, so it can pick up where the light rays are striking the display and what direction they're going in, and then we can project them into the virtual world. We also work with sound.
It can send messages that convey the mood of the sender.
I forgot there
was sound. Finally, I've got the voice recognition done.
It can translate gestures into text annotations.
So there's an example of speech and gesture together as a modality of doing input and output. And we've done a lot of work with that. The speech part's becoming pretty common now that everybody has Siri on their iPhones. But the speech and gesture together makes it even
modern
more powerful.
Computing.
It can highlight words as they are spoken.
Called As We May Think.
The system offers voice-activated search.
I see a picture of one of our bush.
You can use gestures to click and drag.
This is a nice picture. Let's select it, drag it, and drop it here.
So we have a much longer version of this video. It's called Kugel is the system, and it's demonstrating how to make search both more personal and more portable. Sense of touch, big one we're used to using, but rather than just talking about touch on the screen, we like to take advantage of our kinesthetics, our touch, in all kinds of ways. This is an example project where we connect your wallet to the cloud to understand your finances and then give you feedback on how you're doing with your budgeting goals by making the wallet easier or harder to open. So we take that expression, money being tight, and we make it literal. We've also got some work we're doing here with making capacitive connections between objects. So here's a capacitive identified index business card working in conjunction with a regular iPad screen to be identified both in its position and whose business card it is. So the idea of using objects together, fiducials, as part of your sense of touch. Here's another example of that system where you can sort of see it recognize the object, you can rotate it around, and it can respond. Well, I'm going to move it around first. We've still got some lag issues here. This is the first time I've actually ever shown this work publicly, so enjoy it. And the device has bidirectional communication with the screen, capacitive in. It can modulate the capacitance to send data into the screen, and light on the way out. If the screen behind it modulates the light, it can pay attention. And so here's like another little example of that, of where it can sort of act as a copy and paste device from one screen to another. And here its own little on-off affordance is on the screen, so it has a light on it itself. This little dome has an LED inside of it, and here you put it up to an iPad, and then you get an on-off button to turn the light on and off, which is kind of a fun way to think about how some future interactions might work between devices. We also played around a little bit with taste. We're getting a little bit more into the media art space here maybe, but we made a system that formulates your toothpaste for you on demand every morning to give you a weather report. This is actually multimodal too. If it was warmer, if weather's trending warmer, it made it cinnamony. If it was trending colder, it would make it minty. And then to let you know about precipitation, it could make the toothpaste a solid white or striated blue and white stripes. So I guess there was some visual to that, too.
What did that tell you this morning when you used this toothpaste?
Yeah, I don't have the portable version yet, but it would have been cinnamony if I'd had it. Heat is an unused source of interface. We did a project called My Ears Are Burning that connected activity about you on the social networks to heating up your ears. Again, trying to make a saying come true. And we also did some stuff with smell, which, for the sake of time, I'm going to pass it over to Alex and not talk about it too much, except to say that people are really resistant to making technology that intentionally stinks. So we're not quite sure where to go with that. Alex? Oh, yeah. My pleasure.
All right, thank you. Yeah, my name is Alex Oval. I'm a researcher in the Media Lab in the Camera Culture Group. And I think, like most of the people on the panel, I'm really excited about new types of interaction techniques and user experiences that are enabled by new interface technology. So for me, a lot of the importance in interacting with tasks and trying to amplify what you're trying to do is dependent on unobtrusiveness and seamlessness in the interface. So the two main things that enable that is some sort of sensing and some sort of display technology that sort of interprets and facilitates your interaction. And a lot of the work that we're doing deals with hybrid combinations of sensing, displays, and interaction. And this borrows heavily from augmented reality, ubiquitous computing, spatial aware handhelds, and interactive surfaces, and so on. So I'll show you a few examples of my work that deals with this. One thing that we did a couple years ago was really looking at fluid interactions with touchscreen displays that seamlessly combine pen interaction and touch interaction. So really trying to remove all sorts of widgets and toolbars and menus and so on, but still have like the precision of the pen with the fluidity of touch. So here's a sort of a rubbing gesture that gives you very minimal input but a lot of expressiveness. We do a lot of things that combine different displays to sort of leverage the best of both. So in this case, here we have a rear projected CT scan that's combined with the tracked handheld display that gives both a higher resolution viewport into this projection as well as a high resolution input. So the touchscreen on this handheld is much higher resolution than what the large surface is able to provide. So this is sort of one such example. And then for the in terms of the CT scan, you can switch between different examinations and so on. So it also becomes a sort of a tangible filter that you move on the surface. So really having both displays work in tandem, where the surface gives you the context and the handheld gives you the focus. This also, of course, applies to larger screens and multiple devices. So we're very excited about collaboration between multiple users across multiple devices, so leveraging not only the different displays, but also form factors. Some devices may have like a physical keyboard, which may be beneficial for certain scenarios, where other ones have larger touchscreen displays and so on. So the idea here is that regardless of where you are, you can have multiple people collaborating in seamless environment. In this case, we're envisioning maybe a surgeon at a hospital quickly calls in a remote expert, and they have like this shared space with different form factors in their personal devices. And also, this moves forward into other types of displays. Here we're exploring a bunch of different input devices for a novel 3D display that we had back at KTH where I worked previously. So there's various ways to interact, a little bit similar to the BiDi screen, except these are different input technologies. So here we have the mobile acting as a remote controller to this holographic optical element-based 3D display. There's an integrated touch layer on the surface, and then we use a depth camera to sort of control the 3D content on a display. And now we're actually also looking at much smaller types of sensing. So all of these technologies were sort of focusing on sensing and displays that are embedded in the environment and surrounding you. So one of our most recent projects is called SpeckleSense, which looks at embedded motion sensing. It's actually a really compact platform to do motion sensing with everyday electronics. And this is something that we're now, together with my collaborator Jan Žižka and Andy Bardaji, have turned into actually a little board that will plug into an Arduino shield. I'll show you some of the examples what it enables. So the point here is that this exploits some tricks with optics and laser light. So we're using it to track a mobile display with very low power and very high update rates. We can turn embedded displays into gesture sensitive, and it allows us to build new input devices. So I won't take more time, but if you're interested in this, you should check out specklesense.org and get in touch with us. We're trying to actually get these boards out now to various collaborators around. So, thank you.
Can we switch back to Brent's video? My name is David Minnan. I work at Oblong Industries, which is a tech startup in Los Angeles. Can you play the GoodCom video?
Sure.
This shows some of the gestural work that we've been working on. We use the Kinect in this video, but we work with other sensing technologies such as time of flight and stereo cameras. We're interested in building more accessible gestural interfaces. So instead of using a full body skeleton tracker and gross body motion, we track the hand very precisely, and we recognize different hand shapes. So when you do a particular interaction, like we call this pushback, where you take control of the whole screen, your hand has to be in the right shape to trigger that event. And since our hands are so dexterous and we have such good control, we believe that this allows us to build more richer, more powerful, more nuanced interfaces. Part of our story is to bring together different devices. So here you have bare hand tracking. Anyone can walk up and use the system. But you can also use the device that's in your pocket. So here it's an iPhone, so you can swipe. We also provide some technology that connects your phone to the system so you can control a cursor. And in the next video, we'll show some other devices that can also be hooked in to the multi-device ecosystem that our technology creates. Great. Can you switch to the GridCom one? So one of the motivating observations at Oblong Industries is that we largely live in a world where we have one application running on one computer with one user. But we're moving in the direction of having very large displays, like Brent was talking about, multiple users and multiple programs with different data and different visualizations. So Minority Report was referenced earlier. John Underkoffler was the science advisor who created that interface through his PhD work at MIT and made it popular through the movie. After that, he founded Oblong Industries to take that science fiction, to take that vision and make it into a commercially viable company. And so we've built many sensing technologies. Here we see an optical system where the user wears a glove. We have an ultrasonic wand that's tracked with very high precision in 3D with both the position and orientation. And then we have a really talented set of designers who use that sensing to build usable, seamless interfaces. And we're showing a few examples here. So our goal is to build these kind of multi-user collaborative systems that allow you to bring your technology as well as the sensing technology that we're developing into a system to facilitate collaboration and shared work.
Hi, my name is Luis Francisco Revilla, and I'm an assistant professor in the School of Information here in Austin. And I don't have slides because I was told not to have slides.
My fault.
However, a large part of my research is focusing on the use of the different technologies. What is the impact of the new technologies that we have nowadays in different groups, and the consideration of the combination of multiple stakeholders. So, for instance, what is the effect of multi-touch technology on the people with visual impairments or the people with cognitive impairments? And the work that we do at the school, it uses a lot of the open source software that is available for the current technologies like Kinect, multi-touch, and we recombine them into new solutions. So the approach was to see what is the effect on these populations that typically they're not looked as the first or primary user group, but oftentimes people pay attention to them after the fact as a secondary population. That, oh, yeah, maybe we can do something for them. So the focus was to try to put this upside down and say, well, what if we look at this first? And so we've been working on this area. The areas where we apply this is the future of TV. So we're looking at sharing different interfaces. How can you have a session that actually is pretty much the whole day where you start watching TV at home and then you move on the subway, assuming that there's a subway in your city that we don't have in Austin. And then you go to office. So that transition and selection of a combination of the recommender system for a contextual location and device-aware combination, that's what we're looking at. In the terms of people with cognitive disabilities, some of my students have been working with children with autism, and it's interesting to note how we had to recombine the different technologies. Some of the projects they were working on, they tried to use multi-touch, and it was interesting because this student, she has a son with autism, and who couldn't use the system because it was very touch-averse. So it was interesting how for these particular populations, the need to adapt is even bigger. So this this particular child would prefer to have a stylus and have pen interaction, but it wouldn't touch. Other children actually prefer the touch and cannot handle the pen, or they lose the pen all the time. So it's a very interesting area where we had to recombine all the things. So it's kind of learning how to walk again. And so that's the main aspect of my research, is how do we study this and how do we recombine these effects, these technologies into different areas.
Thanks, everybody. Okay, so we're going to continue with the questions. Again, following out the Twitter hashtags, South by Southwest, hashtag gesture. If any of you have any questions, want to direct it to one of our panelists, let me know. I'll monitor it. Otherwise, I'm going to continue with some of the questions we have formulated for the panel. The next one is, how are our interface technologies affecting everyday life? Are we facilitating interaction? Are we frustrating it? Are we enhancing productivity? So who wants to take the question? Okay, Henry?
Well, I'll just start with, you know, hopefully this will spur some other people thinking, but, you know, Microsoft had it pretty good in that ad they ran for the Windows 7 mobile where we seem to be in a world now of everybody looking down at their phone all the time and wandering around and potentially bumping into each other. And kind of our interfaces right now isolate you from the environment. And so I think what's great about this range of research you've seen here is it's trying to take people and put them back in the environment, making them aware of other people, making them aware of where they are, and really making them look up instead of looking down. So I think that's one answer.
Great.
Yeah, I think along those lines, I think a lot of people, just using the example of the Kinect, a lot of people are very interested in making the Kinect control a screen. And in a lot of ways, it's not the best device for doing that because it has a low-resolution sensor. And what it's very good at doing is doing things like recognizing you through voice, through its depth sensor. It can really get a sense of identity, and it can identify you. And the Xbox does that. It does facial recognition and identifies you when you walk up to the Xbox. And I think that's one of the ways that these devices can be used in interfaces differently than what we've shown a lot right now is just moving objects on the screen. And another thing I saw when we were doing this and how they're used in everyday life is that we obviously use the iPhone, and the iPhone, I think, is the number one example of a successful multi-touch technology, and it kind of introduced it to the market. I think Windows is now, Microsoft is now getting on that, and they're releasing Windows 8, which is their native multi-touch OS. But we've seen in the past that a lot of the operating systems have been ill-designed for the interfaces. So if you tried to use the touch on Windows 7, it's not a lot of fun to try to click the X button or try to close a window or open the start programs. So I think it's very important for these device interfaces to be matched very well with the software interface. And the software interface has to be designed both around the user and the device.
One of the things that I think is changing nowadays is the ability to convey emotion to the computer systems. Facial recognition is one of those ways, but brain interfaces is another way. And how many times do we would like to know our editor to know that we are frustrated, that we cannot find that button, or that they changed the menu and now I'm really angry about it. So I think that's one aspect that new technologies are offering. That is not just what we do, but why we do it for. It's, I can convey emotions. The machine can be a little bit more understanding, which allows a lot more interactions.
I can answer the question with a business product that we've developed called Mezzanine. So it's a high-end conference room system that uses an ultrasonic wand to allow spatial interaction. And I think what's really powerful about it is that we install multiple high-definition screens, we support presentations in the classic sense, but we bring together different people and different devices. So the people in the room can interact with any of the screens just by pointing at them, and there's a button and other interactions. But it also combines some of the ideas from telepresence and video conferencing, so you can connect with people that are remote. And we have interactions through your iPad or your iPhone. And so anyone can interact at the same time. It's mediated socially and through the technology. And it creates an environment in which there's a lot of flexibility to match the workflow of the particular business. And we've really had a strong response. So people hear this and, okay, we've all heard of smart offices before, but when they actually get in the room and use it, they're like, oh, it really makes a difference that I can instantly upload from my device to that device, or put my video on that screen, or take a snapshot of a whiteboard and put it on the screen over there. And it changes the way the meeting flows, and it allows people, and we've seen this, we actually see people get more work done and not just have a meeting that's, you know, about setting more meetings.
And I think what everyone, like, the theme here is a little bit coming back to the seamlessness and the ability of interface technology to slice away all the bulkiness between you and what you actually want to do. In terms of telepresence, it also slices away the distance, the geographical distance between you and whoever you want to communicate and collaborate with. But I think that we're also seeing a shift from sort of consumption to production right now, which is also somewhat seen in consumer devices. So while multi-touch has gained like enormous traction, I look at a lot of people in the audience, there's no tactile feedback, so it actually sucks in all your attention to your input modalities. If you want to type, you actually need to actually look at what you're typing. You can't touch type, right? So what we're seeing now, like from CES, sort of the stylus is coming back as a tool for a bunch of mobile devices and tablets, and maybe that's also an indication of the fact that we want to produce and we want to sort of mimic and maybe devices and that are analog that have been successful in the past. And I think that's sort of something that's important not to forget, that a flat surface with no response or texture is not how we've evolved over the many years that we've developed like this amazing tactile sense in our fingertips. So I think we're coming back to exploiting more of the innate capabilities of the human body. And that's sort of ties very nicely in with gestures and so on. So.
Yeah, I think along your lines, Alex, I've heard somebody say once that you can tie your shoes if you close your eyes, but it's very difficult to tie your shoes if you have numb fingers and you can't feel your fingers. So I think a lot of our interfaces today are very non-haptic, and you can't feel much. It's everything's behind glass, or with a Kinect, you're even farther removed from the interface. So I think that's a great explanation that we can sometimes forget to use our senses, all of our senses, in that way.
And that that fits to our next question. And also, a few people in our attendance here have asked Are new interface technologies alienating? And this has to do, you know, with the visually impaired, literacy, age, different in cultures, different languages. And also another follow-up to that question was, what would happen if you took this technology that you have presented today and took it to a village? You know, how would that improve their life? So who wants to tackle that question?
For as far as alienating, I think there's a lot of different ways to alienate somebody from a device. There's alienating people just if the interface isn't designed well, or there's alienating based on the language or what somebody expects when using the interface. I think one thing I saw was that just using the Kinect and working with that, some people have innate notions of how control is happening and how their movements or their hands should control a model. And the way I had implemented it was not the way somebody expected it to be used. And so I feel like different cultures or different people may have preconceived notions about how something works. And just because something works in the United States or America with this interface doesn't mean it's going to work somewhere else in the world, because other cultures may have different notions of how to interact.
However, what I would say is that it's not the technology that alienates. Is how we use that technology. Multi-touch can be very difficult to use for visually impaired people if you want them to find the icon and then click on it. However, you can design the multi-touch differently, that first you click on it and then things appear around your finger. I mean, we can design things for people with different disabilities, but we have to think of them first. Same thing with different cultures. The implications of one aspect in one culture, they don't always translate. So there's a need to do this research and understand these other cultures. But sometimes the first step is to be able to, can I make it? So I also see value in investigating new technologies. Can we actually even make this happen? But after doing that, is how can I make this work in these different contexts, which I think is not necessarily alienating, it's just another step in the research area.
And following that, there's this notion of design for all in the assistive technologies community, which is this idea that if we design things as inclusive as possible, we also may discover a lot of nuances that will be helpful to sort of the broader population. So for instance, in this case, if you have a touchscreen interface that actually is... it does not demand 100% visual attention, then that's actually useful not only to someone that's visually impaired, or if you're able to provide haptic feedback through the display, then that's also beneficial. So I think that is something very important to take in to have like a broad picture, not just think about Tom Cruise with like glowing cool lights on his sweet designer gloves. I don't know. But also think about really what's the least prepared user for this system, and use the technology to equip them with proper feedback, proper adaptation, support discoverability of the interface, and not to forget also being able to scale up to expert modes. And there's a lot of fantastic research in HCI that does this, like marking menus and all sorts of things.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that underneath it all, the reason we're trying these new interface technologies is to empower, not to alienate. And so, to some extent, I suppose if it differentially empowers people, it could widen the gap. And that's really maybe what this question is about: is, you know, how do we make sure that we keep that gap as small as possible? And I think we've had some good answers to that.
Yeah.
I'd like to add some experience with the deaf community. My graduate lab did a lot of work with American Sign Language, so it's a very complicated gestural language. But I think it was very clear that kind of research can help the community. So in particular, some of our work was targeted at education. So you'll often see children who are deaf but come from hearing parents that don't know sign language. And so we developed some tools that were interactive games that would teach different signs and teach some of the vocabulary and grammar of American Sign Language, and did studies in the deaf school in Atlanta and got real results. So It's great if all technologies can benefit all people, but it's also good if, as Henry was saying, if it's differential. And some technologies might benefit one group, and that can be positive as well.
All right, so I'll move on to the next question. Great questions by everybody, by the way. This is a question that causes a little bit of controversy. We also talk about gesture vocabulary for those that are developing applications or for those that go between different devices. You might have noticed that each device uses different gestures. It could be frustrating. So from that, you know, is there a gesture vocabulary? Should we design a new gesture vocabulary? If so, should the gestures be patented? How does the patenting affect the gestures in consumer devices? Henry?
Yeah, sure. I kind of put this into, I sort of think of it as two categories, and maybe that means I'm ambivalent. But there's sort of the category of maybe like a, you know, somebody developing a very specialized suite of gestures for a very specialized application. Perhaps it makes sense for them to be able to get some kind of exclusivity in patenting in order to do a deep dive into maybe the best way to do telerobotic surgery, just to make up an example. What should the gesture set be for that? But then on the flip side, when we're talking about consumer devices, I feel pretty strongly that we want to have uniform experiences across all of our devices, and that the experience should be owned by the consumers, not by the companies that are making the devices because of that. And we need to move away from letting companies have control of how we use their devices and take that control. And so I would avoid, personally, making proprietary gestures for consumer devices.
Yeah. David?
So I think intellectually I agree completely. I know Oblong has patented a few gestures, so that's the way business works. I think that we need to explore the space, that we should push towards standardization, but I don't think we know what the right gestures are for each device or each use case right now, so I think there's a lot of research that should be done. I also think that there can be some middle ground. So we do have some patents, but we are releasing an open SDK for anyone to use them, so for non-commercial use. So I hope that that proves useful to the community and people can build upon that, and that's what's supposed to happen in the with intellectual property rights.
All right, this is when the panel gets interesting. I think that this idea of patenting how I, as a human being, interact with anything is completely insane. I mean,
there you go.
Thank you. I mean, just one simple counterexample. What if, and this is already existent in a lot of devices. If you have like user-defined gestures, does this mean that I can as an end user, I buy a device and I can't define how I interact with that technology? I think that's crazy. So no patents. I think I want to be completely liberated as a human being interacting with technology or anything around me.
I build stuff and evaluate stuff. I'm not a lawyer. So I guess it makes sense to me that you can patent a process to recognize a gesture, but for me it doesn't make sense to patent that gesture. That's mm-hmm. things we do as a human being. Again, I'm not a lawyer, so. But I don't want, same with Alex, I don't want to be constrained about this particular gesture. Some of my students are working on gesture vocabularies for medicine, trying to release the hands of or the eyes of the doctor to interact with technology while at the operating table. It would be terrible that, no, you cannot use that gesture because it's already taken. But that's the only gesture I can do when I have one hand holding the heart of someone. Sorry. But that's my personal view.
Yeah,
I mean, I personally don't even like to use closed source software that much, even though I've got an Apple right here. But I really, you know, a closed source gesture just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I just Googled this, and it looks like Apple patented some multi-touch gestures. But it's very application specific, so I don't know that they're patenting the specific, you know, Zoom gesture or anything like that. It's application specific for their movie editor. I'm kind of curious how you would enforce something like this. Like, oh, he's using my gesture, I'm going to sue him. I mean, I don't really understand how that would be enforced. And I think Henry told me that the MIT Media Lab doesn't generally enforce their patent. I don't know how true that is.
I've been outed. Actually, I said that MIT.
Okay.
MIT tends not to be litigious as an institution. So it does patent, though, quite extensively, but it doesn't tend to be very litigious.
I think it's worth saying that I think we actually all agree and would also agree that our patent system is broken right now, especially in the software world. We have these same kind of problems with algorithms, with gestures, and it's a different panel, but we do need some lawyers, and we do need, as a community and as a culture, to fix the way we protect intellectual property and the way we share it.
Yeah, I just want to comment on the, you know, it's a very short distance between patenting a gesture and patenting a process that recognizes a gesture. That's a slippery slope that any lawyer will be able to take you down.
I know.
If you want to go down.
But the thing is, so we were working with different vocabularies, and at some point it's very hard to distinguish one gesture from another gesture. Last semester, some of my students were working on an interface. It was a Kinect interface for a bar. So you can interact with big TV with gestures. And so you have the typical gesture that you go sideways. But what happens, it was on the side, so people actually had a hand down, and this was the same gesture. So suddenly, while intellectually the gesture was horizontal swipe, in reality was an arc going down. What is that gesture?
Yeah, that goes to the whole...
Which one is it? Do we consider the same or not? Is intentionality behind the gesture what we're talking about?
Sounds like a patent violation to me.
Okay, well, I'll move on to a very interesting question, something that we've been talking about and a couple of people from the audience have asked. Have you guys considered about muscular fatigue? You're in front of these screens, you know, as we saw Brent there in front of the screens moving around. Have you considered about muscular fatigue, physical fatigue, about people actually with their hands gesturing? Maybe in the future, you know, you guys are going to, everybody that's doing gestures, everybody's going to be fit.
I actually heard that somebody told me that in the future the computer nerds are going to be the ones that have the big muscles. So you know, I don't know, but I can tell you from experience that the whole reaching gesture with the Kinect is not a good way to do it. And just in the lab doing that for 3 minutes, I get I guess they call it the gorilla arm, where you feel like this. So I found that a much more natural way to do it is just a kind of a flick of the wrist or something, a small movement of your arm. So I definitely think that's an issue. And I've never been fatigued using multi-touch apps, but I don't know if you guys have anything else to add to that.
So I think so what we're trying to do in ACI is to provide as many methods as possible to sense the user's interaction, right? And using adaptive camera is one, and it enables certain types of interactions. But I think the importance is to, you know, what's the actual task or the interface, or what are you really trying to accomplish, and how do you combine the sensing with the input that makes the most sense for that input? So maybe for, I don't know, navigating a website, doesn't make sense to use anything but the mouse, for instance. So we actually, for a simple task of like navigating a 3D model, we actually did some experiments on the 3D display that I showed earlier, and a lot of our users actually preferred just a single touch screen that was overlaid on this display rather than doing stuff in front of it, and for the very simple reason of getting the tactile feedback of knowing when you're actually controlling it or not, so you feel the surface, and you have like a sort of passive tactile feedback as you move your finger around on the surface. So I think it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish. And I mean, a gesture-based interface gives you a completely different set of degrees of freedom and expressiveness compared to a touchscreen. But I think that's sort of where it lies. You know, the right interface and the right hardware for the right task, and ideally as much feedback through as many senses as possible.
I really think that's spot on. I mean, we see Minority Report, and that was designed to work, but to look good in a movie, right? It was fiction. It's supposed to be stylized. And I think what Alex just said, you know, the right tool for the right interaction, the right job is exactly right. We also address the problem at Oblong in a couple different ways. So one, speaking directly to gesture, we look at what I might call a micro gesture, as Brent was saying. So instead of a large, you know, full body motion, it might just be a simple finger gesture where you do get some tactile feedback from your own hand. And the other perspective is one of design. So if you try to use an application, you know, drive a web page that was designed over the course of the last, you know, maybe even 40 years around a mouse and a keyboard using gesture, maybe it doesn't fit. But if we design new interactions and new applications that are built around gesture or built around a wand or built around touch, then I think the match will be much better, the fatigue will be much lower, and the overall user experience will be much better.
I think also the context matters a lot. I mean, for me, it was so surprising the interface with the bar, because I realized how people, we are lazy. So instead of doing swipe, people put their elbow down. People start minimizing the effort, and they will find a way to work around. That interface also showed a lot of the problems with the context. If I put the hand up, am I calling for the waiter? Do I want a check? Or am I saying, because they had a push, so they actually had to have like intentionality, hand gesture to say, no, I'm interacting with the system. I'm not calling the someone to come and help me. So we have to think as we move on to real life environments that it's not just interaction human computer, but it's the whole context. And I think all systems tend to go there.
So the first time I got a demonstration of the technology that goes underlies the Kinect by the people who created it, I was really struck by how whenever they went to do a demonstration, their entire posture and demeanor changed. You know, they were relaxed and happy while they were talking, and then they would say, now we'll show you this, and they would straighten up, and while they were doing their things, they would look really unhappy and tense. And, you know, I went through the course of that. Their presentation was phenomenally exciting, yet I went from feeling like I wanted the technology to feeling like the technology wasn't ready yet in watching that. And looking out at sort of like what's out there on the market now, I think that people have taken the approach of making sure that the applications that are out there match well with what the technology can do. And then what you're seeing from the researchers is trying to work on this very problem. So my conclusion would be to this question is it's not ready yet. In that general way. This is something people need to work on and are working on.
Okay. So moving on to probably our final question so we can open up to the audience. Since you guys, MIT Media Lab and Oblong, so what's the key to getting an interface technology adopted by consumers? You know, what made the mouse so successful? And this was actually one of the questions. What of these things that you are showing we can't do with the mouse? With the keyboard's, you know, haptic in the sense you have some sense. So what is the key to getting these new technologies adopted by consumers? And this is, you know, inspire the audience to get into the business.
I would say participatory design. Get the consumers on the design of the application. We see all these different tools, but, I mean, it's like dancing. They tell us, we know the steps. But you tell us how to put the overall dancing. If I have this ability to use the mouse, well, sometimes the mouse is better. Some of the tables that we built this huge table, and the first thing people did is put the keyboard and the mouse on top of the table, which was really frustrating for a while. Eventually, we said, yeah, we have to have all these different systems, but we need to have the people that are going to use it participate in the design. Now, this is a secondary level of research. It's not the first level of research. Can we make this work? This is, okay, how do we apply these things that we know they work into these different contexts?
So if you look at the mouse, and if you look at touch, yep, and now you look at speech, the flippant answer to that would be Steve Jobs is how you get it out there, which would also be a little bit depressing at the moment.
Yep.
But the reason I bring it up in reaction to what you just said is he had exactly the opposite approach to what you said. He said, we have to tell the consumers what they want, and believed very strongly in not doing like focus groups and participatory design. So I'm not saying I know the answer, but I'm not sure.
Maybe Steve Jobs had really good insight of what people wanted. I cannot say that I always had that insight. I mean, I prefer to ask.
He had the killer app. I mean, with the with the iPhone, that is the application that got multi-touch accepted, and now you've got everybody having tablets and everything. So I think you need that killer app to get that technology out there and used by the masses. And with the Xbox 360 Kinect, I'm not sure what the killer app for that is, besides the video games and dancing and things. It's not clear what that killer app is going to be, or if there is a killer app for that. So,
well, we have
getting it right.
Getting it right. How do we get it right?
Yeah. No frustration.
Yeah, frustration. Okay, so we have around 8 minutes for questions. There's a microphone right over there in the second. Please speak really closely to the microphone.
Yes, so I was trying to Twitter this question, but I'll do it this way.
Sorry.
It's in life and in this research, it's always good to have a grand challenge. For me, this panel is about high-end technology, and maybe I'm misinterpreting it, and eventually making its way into lower-cost realms. We talk a lot about consumers, and so my question to you is, how is your technology relevant to bridging the digital divide? And I'd like to give you an example. Should we be thinking about, not about the $100 laptop, but the $500 system that can be owned by a village, as an example? How and when will your work be relevant to the people who are not even online yet? Thanks.
So is the question,
you want to repeat?
Yes. How do we bridge divides?
How do we bridge divides?
Sorry, it was a little bit hard to hear up here.
Yeah,
the echoes. But
how can your work address the digital divide?
Bridge the digital divide. Yeah.
So most of the world, at least the developing world, the laptop or the desktop computer is not the main point of access to the web. It's a cell phone, which is already having this kind of technology. So in a way, it is happening that way. Now, it is true that oftentimes we don't design for them first. It's like, oh, yeah, they got a cell phone. They don't have enough money to buy a laptop, but everybody has a cell phone. So I think these technologies are becoming more relevant in that context. Now, that's just an observation. I don't know if that answers your question.
And to a large extent, this also ties into the previous question. But I mean, we need to solve problems, and we choose which problems we're solving. And Steve Jobs, he chose to invent the problems that they're solving. And it seemed to be very popular problems that made the iDevices successful. On another note, like what we're actually trying to do with the speckle sense thing is actually making that accessible and making motion sensing extremely small and very cheap. So this is a board that's a few dollars that will like give you gestural input to control device. If that's relevant for the other end of the digital divide, that's something that's debatable, but maybe something that's more relevant in a few years. So again, if someone is interested in talking about this, I'll be around all week.
Okay. I think there's two elements to the divide. There's kind of an element that's the cost factor, but there's another element that's sort of the training factor, the understanding the technology. And I think the kinds of stuff we're all working on here are trying to make technology that understands people instead of forcing people to understand the technology. And so in that regard, I think we are all very focused on bridging a particular digital divide. Now, the cost divide, that's kind of that's a pretty straightforward thing often. Once you figure out what to do, then to figure out how to do it cheaply is an easier problem.
Okay. All right, we continue with the next question.
So you're all describing attributes of good user interface. What would you say is an example of a bad user experience in technology?
So bad example of user experience and technology?
I think there are some examples in gesture because we're just starting out. So one common interaction that we see is sort of hover to click. So you move a virtual cursor over something and then you hold it there for a few seconds to activate. And I don't think anyone finds that particularly comfortable or pleasant. It's a good solution. It makes a lot of sense where it's used given the constraints right now. But I think that from a design perspective and a technology perspective, we can and will do a lot better.
Okay. Yeah. So next question, please. I'll just try to get more questions.
Somehow, when I go to embodied interaction like Kinect and that kind of interactions, in a way, we're back into the prompt. I mean, we lost the menu that tells us what can you do when it's there in my face. With the Kinect, there's a camera looking at me to move. And that maybe explains the rigidity of people trying to get it right. But discovering the gesture becomes an issue. How do I tell people what is the gesture vocabulary? Maybe I discovered the natural ones. And we can do something about metaphors and walking, but some are very hard, so we might need some training. And that goes into the idea of patenting gestures.
Next question, please.
Hello. Have you brought any of your projects to a commercial kiosk space? And if you have, what sort of clients have you had?
I couldn't understand.
Have you brought your products to a kiosk space, like in a commercial arena, where customers of a company would come up and use it?
So, like, if you were to advertise a product at a kiosk, how would you adapt these kind of interfaces to that?
I was wondering if you guys have actually done that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Are you alive?
Yeah. So we actually. I'm from Sweden. So we have a small company where we do sort of museum type installations. So here's actually two projects that combine a lot of these ideas. The lower one is it's a multi-touch system for a museum to explore more about the exhibit, and it sort of ties in with RFID, so you can sort of store and carry with you information that you bring home and sort of prolong the museum experience. So that's, I would call that, sort of a kiosk that combines a lot of like the sensing and the display elements that we've talked about. That's.
We're also working on a kiosk product based around iPhone interactions and gesture. It's at the R&D level right now. You can maybe talk more about it afterward. I think that something didn't come up that's really important is where gesture makes sense. And so one of the areas we talked about outside of gaming is when the user is either very dirty or needs to be very clean. So you can think of a doctor, and we saw an example, right? So a surgeon needs to keep their hands sterile, so you want a gestural interface, or say a mechanic has grease or a chef has whatever on their hands and doesn't want to muddy the interface. And so we're looking at applications like that in addition to sort of the classic digital signage space.
We have a current project about kiosks in the university environment and also interacting with a cell phone application. And some of the people working are in the room, so you might want to speak with them.
Okay. All right, next question. We have only a minute left, so let's try to answer as many as we can.
It's really about when is a gesture right to use? So the question I'd ask is, it feels that gestures are really linked to our identity. And is there best place actually to be used in identification management and in introductions, and then let the application design be done by another interface that doesn't need the gestures to do it? It feels like a lot of the gesture work at the moment is at the application end instead of what it's really brilliant at, which is what we use it for at the moment, which is introductions and identity management.
I'm sorry, I couldn't understand your question.
Okay, so
maybe speak a little bit lower.
Yeah, maybe a little bit farther away from the.
Okay, so are gestures best use for introductions as we currently use them to tell us about who I am as a person? So very short, sharp interactions versus hardcore power user application design, where its use might not be the best over other types of HCI interface.
Anyone have to tackle that? So gestures that will tell you, who you are, right? Small instead of general gestures.
I think you're suggesting the idea that gestures are better for short interactions rather than extended ones. Is that the nature of the question?
How we currently use gestures, even when we're in a bar or when we're there, actually the huge amount is about identity, about who I am, and then the initial introduction with someone else. So that's what I'm saying. So, and implicitly, that is a short, sharp interaction that then someone else identifies with. So it's about recognizing an identity management versus. Does that make sense?
Recognizing someone by the gestures they make?
Yeah, so he's saying, day to day you have different gestures to say hi, and, so he's saying things like recognizing people by the gesture they make, or what about those gestures that are more, you're designing for general gestures instead of maybe the gestures that people make every day.
I think I'm going to try to answer this question. I think one part that is tricky, and that's what Henry
was talking about earlier, is that what is really natural when I start interacting with a computer, when you're on the phone and there's like a voice-based input, you speak very differently than when you talk to another person. Same thing with the Kinect. You sort of change your posture and you want to help the computer better understand you, although probably the algorithms are written for you to be as relaxed as possible. So I think there's a difference between trying to have interfaces that are as natural as possible, and I think those are maybe better when there's not an explicit input, when I'm not feel like I'm controlling it, but it's more sensing my overall motion and state, versus the type of expert user interface that you mentioned, where I really want to be in control and I want to be effective, and it's adapting to the capabilities of my body, but it's not necessarily one-to-one mapping to what I would normally do in my everyday life.
So we're already a little bit over time. So if you guys, the questions you have, you guys want to just come up to the panelists. But otherwise, thank you very much for coming and joining us. Have a great rest of South by.